Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When we last assembled here on Friday, we told you the heat's been rising for the Federal Reserve. The dollar's value keeps falling, pushing prices for oil, food, and other things higher. Which brings us to today. Across the Atlantic, inflation has jumped even more than feared. The European Central Bank may have no choice but to raise interest rates over there. And guess what? That could make our dollars worth even less. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by BrandWeek, the news organization dedicated to the information needs of strategic-minded marketing executives with real-time coverage, now searchable at brandweek.com. And by gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Monday, the last day of June. There was a real dilemma shaping up today for our friends in Europe, where new figures show consumer prices are rising fast to an all-time high of 4%. That inflation jump all but cinches an interest rate hike over there this week. But here's the catch. If you raise rates, you make investing in the euro more attractive, and the U.S. greenback is almost certain to suffer. What's more, an influential study out today is warning of a serious slowdown for the global economy, suggesting that it's not a good idea to kick the dollar when it's down. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The Bank for International Settlements, or BIS, represents the world's top 55 central banks. In its annual report out today, it paints a grim picture of the global economy. Governments and individuals are weighed down with debt, says the bank. It may not take too much to tip them into default. A very severe downturn could follow. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard is a financial correspondent with the Daily Telegraph. He says the BIS is worried that some central banks may miscalculate.
Their fear is that if the central banks raise interest rates in order to deal with an inflationary spike caused by oil and food, they could tip the whole thing right over and make it much, much worse. You could get yourself into a situation that's a little bit like the 1930s.
This week, the European Central Bank, or ECB, meets to set euro interest rates. Inflation is the major concern. Today, it's had an all-time high for the eurozone of 4%. The ECB will now very likely raise rates to slow growth, in spite of the BIS report. Economist Andrew Hilton.
It sees these inflationary pressures, on the whole, as more damaging in the short term than the threat of a major economic downturn.
And he says, unlike the Federal Reserve, the ECB has only one duty: to bear down on inflation.
That is the mandate of the European Central Bank. It doesn't have a mandate to maintain growth. It does have a mandate to hold down inflation.
Officials at the BIS are said to be resigned to the likelihood that the ECB will raise rates, but they're waiting and hoping for a sign from Frankfurt that it's won and done. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We're wrapping up the first half of the year, and these times have been downright biblical. Tornadoes, hail, floods. Now wildfires blazing through Northern California have destroyed at least 50 buildings. The only thing missing, it seems, is locusts. Insurance claims are approaching $9 billion, more than all of last year by a couple billion. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports on just how well the insurance industry is covered itself.
The last time mid-year claims were this high was in 1994, after the Northridge earthquake in Southern California. This year, it's tornadoes, which have ripped through the Midwest. Losses from the Mississippi floods will be covered mostly by the federal government. Robert Hartwig is president of the Insurance Information Institute.
Though it's been the busiest year in quite some time for catastrophe losses, the insurance industry overall is in quite good financial shape.
Hartwig says 2007 was the lowest year for property casualty losses in history. That's allowed insurers to accumulate a massive rainy day fund.
As of the end of the first quarter of 2008, it stood at about $516 billion.
The insurance industry has taken heat from consumer watchdogs for record profits in recent years. The Consumer Federation reported that from 2004 to 2007, the industry made more than $250 billion.
These profits are obscene.
Attorney Ray Borges is author of Insult to Injury. He says despite record profits, insurance companies may use this year's heavy tornado season to justify increased premiums.
When they have a good year, they just chalk it up to brilliance on the part of the insurance company. And when they have a bad year, they use it for an excuse to raise premiums.
With hurricane season just getting started, the bulk of claims may still be yet to come. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
The world's biggest online auctioneer, eBay, is being told to cough up a lot of French bread. The damages awarded by a court in Paris today amount to around $63 million. And the ruling could make it harder to find a knockoff of a $1,500 Louis Vuitton handbag. The world's largest luxury goods maker, LVMH, successfully sued to stop the sale of such fakes. A similar case by Tiffany's here in the U.S. is expected to be decided any day now. As Marketplace's Jill Barshay reports, eBay could soon find itself having to police everyone who wants to sell branded goods on its site.
Louis Vuitton claimed 90% of the items carrying its brands on eBay are fake. Tiffany says online sales of counterfeit goods cost manufacturers about $30 billion a year. Susan Scafidi teaches fashion law at Fordham University. She says counterfeiters are hard to catch, so brands are now going after third parties.
Tiffany's argument, LVMH's argument, is essentially that eBay is a landlord and knows that illegal activity is going on the website and isn't stopping it, and that eBay is directly profiting from that illegal activity because eBay gets a percentage of every sale, real or fake.
eBay says it spends more than $20 million a year removing counterfeits from its website. It also encourages trademark and copyright holders to report infringements. Patty Freeman-Evans studies online commerce at Jupiter Research. She says if eBay loses its appeals in France and the Tiffany suit here, it's going to have to do a lot more.
What may happen is that eBay will have to put in place regulations for their sellers. So if you want to list the following brands, you must provide us with either an official statement that you are an authorized seller or actual serial numbers of the products.
Freeman Evans says these kinds of rules could end up making it difficult for the rest of us to sell used designer goods, like that Louis Vuitton bag you don't want anymore. And it won't be good for eBay either. The company says a significant chunk of its business is secondary sales. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
The stock market clawed its way back into the green for the most part to wrap up the month. Although, technologically speaking, you might say, the NASDAQ closed the second quarter of the year still in the doldrums. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Run down Fortune magazine's latest list of the nation's best employers, and you'll come across new economy names, including Google, several top law firms, and even companies from the troubled financial sector, such as Goldman Sachs. But nowhere on that list will you find the federal government. Commentator and public policy expert Paul Light says if federal agencies want to compete for the best young talent, they need to try harder.
Federal recruiters have their work cut out for them as the millennials flood the job market over the next few years. This generation sees the federal government as a destination of last resort. The problem is the federal bureaucracy itself. The millennials want meaningful work but don't believe the federal government will provide it. The frustrations begin at the top, where the federal bureaucracy is led by 3,000 political appointees who rarely inspire awe. The good ones give up early, and the bad ones get a good job brownie and a promotion. The bureaucratic sludge rolls its way downhill through layers of needless management and mind-numbing paperwork. There are dozens of rungs between the top and bottom of most agencies. This means that no one can be held accountable, not for the aircraft groundings, toxic trailers, or even bad tomatoes. Yet Congress and the President continue to add more layers and outsource meaningful work. Meanwhile, red tape and cubicles reign supreme. It's like that cult movie, Office Space. Better hang on to the stapler. It may be the last one you'll ever see. These problems cannot be fixed with tinkering. They demand a major overhaul. First, flatten the bureaucracy. Get rid of programs that just don't work. Provide the training to do jobs well and cut the number of layers in half. Most importantly, don't replace the 600,000 baby boomers who will retire over the next decade. Instead, take a look at each job they leave and push the resources down to the front lines. Until Congress and the President commit to the big overhaul, most federal jobs will go to applicants who want a secure paycheck, not the chance to make a difference. And with that kind of motivation, it's only a matter of time before the next disaster.
Paul Light is a professor at the Robert F. Wagner School of Public Service at New York University. He's the author of A Government Ill Executed. Send us your well-executed thoughts, marketplace.org, then click on Contact. It's been a challenge finding much good news about student loans lately. More than 100 private providers pulled out of the student loan market this year. And now Uncle Sam is coming to the rescue with a beefed-up program for federally subsidized loans. In fact, college could become more affordable for 5.5 million students expected to apply for those loans this year. Tess Vigeland is the host of our weekend personal finance program, Marketplace Money, and she's here with the good news. Interest rates on many of those loans are set to fall starting tomorrow. Hey, Tess.
Hey, Bob.
So what exactly happens tomorrow?
Well, you know, July 1st is a really big day each year in the student loan world. Interest rates change, as do some of the other terms of various student loans. This year, it's an even bigger day because since last year, we've seen interest rates drop significantly. Mm-hmm. As you know, the Fed has been cutting and cutting and cutting. So if you're looking to get a new loan, say you're heading off to school in the fall, your fixed rate on a Stafford is going to be lower than last year's freshman got. If you're looking to do some loan consolidation, it's also a good time to lock in a lower rate. And Bob, some two-thirds of undergrads from four-year colleges leave school with this kind of debt. As of 2004, the average bill they left with, more than $19,000. So Anything you can do to pare that back is a good thing.
Okay, give me the good news. What kind of rates are we talking about here?
Well, as you know, the student loan world is populated with all kinds of options, from federally subsidized programs to private lending. A couple of the key factors here are that the fixed interest rate for new subsidized Stafford loans will go from 6.8% to 6%. That's a pretty decent drop. Mm-hmm. That benefits, again, new borrowers. If you've already got Staffords and you're currently in a loan with a variable rate, and that is anyone who borrowed before July 1st, 2006, the variable rate will drop to 4.21%. You know what it's at now? 7.22.
Okay, but when I hear variable rate, the hair stands up on the back of my neck here. Does that mean if rates start going up that you could end up paying more?
No, that's another change here that really benefits the student. If you consolidate starting tomorrow under the new 4.21% rate, that rate is going to lock in. And here's an important point for those who are in school now or about to graduate into their six-month grace period after they graduate. So they haven't started paying yet. The new rate will be just over 3.6%. So it's an even bigger deal for those who are about to graduate. So again, anyone who got these loans before July 1st, 2006, this is an opportunity to save quite a bit on interest.
And if you got your loan after July 1st, 2006?
Unfortunately, you are out of luck. The rate is then fixed at 6.8%, and there's really no reason to bother consolidating.
Now, what about all those lenders who have stopped offering student loans or won't do consolidation loans anymore?
Yeah, you know, this credit crunch, among other things, has prompted all kinds of private banks and other lenders to say, you know what, we are getting out of the student loan business. And that has not been good for people who want to borrow. One solution, and again, this is just for your federal loans, is to consolidate into the government's direct loan program through the Department of Education. You won't be able to do this with your private loans. If you want to consolidate those, you will have to work with the banks. But for your government loans, there is still a government consolidation program that could save you thousands of dollars over the years.
Something to look into. Thanks, Tess. Tess Vigeland hosts our weekend personal finance program, Marketplace Money. Coming up, looking for refuge in a combat zone.
So whatever I can do in anticipation of, let's say, another war, I do it.
But first, let's do the numbers. Oil prices surged and stocks ebbed on this final day of second quarter trading. The Dow Industrial Average gained 3 points, bobbing around the same 11,350 mark where it closed last week. The Nasdaq drifted down 22 points, or nearly 1%, to finish at 2292. The S&P 500 notched up one additional point, about 0.1%, to end at 1280. Oil prices spurted past $143 a barrel before settling around $140. That shored up energy shares. ExxonMobil splashed up 1.8%. Chevron spilled over by 1 1/3. But financial stocks took a bath. Lehman Brothers plunged 11% on fears of continued losses due to the credit crunch. Wachovia bailed out 4.25%. Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase each lost more than 2%. Apple lost 1.5% of its shine, and Research in Motion moved down 3.33%. The yield on the 10-year T-note held steady at 3.96%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for May. In Detroit, automakers report sales figures for the month of June. And bills, circulars, love letters, they all have one thing in common: postage. On July 1st, 1847, the first stamps were issued by the United States Postal Service. Tomorrow is also the 45th anniversary of the five-digit zip code. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. American taxpayers just paid another installment for the long and costly wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. President Bush signed legislation today that funds the operations for the remainder of his term in office and beyond that. The latest package authorizes $162 billion for the next fiscal year. The president praised Congress for coming to a bipartisan agreement that doesn't tie the hands of military commanders.
We owe these brave Americans our gratitude. We owe them our unflinching support. And the best way to demonstrate that support is to give them the resources they need to do their jobs and to prevail.
Congressional authorizations for the five-year-long U.S. military operation in Iraq now total $650 billion. Operations in Afghanistan add close to another $200 billion. We mentioned the price of oil topped $143 a barrel for the first time ever today. At the same time, Iraqi officials opened the bidding for 8 huge oil and gas fields. But they held off announcing formal service contracts for construction of infrastructure improvements. It's estimated the additional fields could raise Iraq's oil production by 1.5 million barrels per day. Right now, the country produces around 2.5 million barrels a day. Mike O'Hanlon is a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, and he's the senior author of their Iraq Index. Mr. O'Hanlon, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Iraq is opening the bids, but it isn't rushing to sign the contracts with U.S. oil companies just yet because it's such a political sore point over there, I take it. What do these contracts give the U.S. companies? Do they give them control, for example?
I don't think that they give them control. I don't think actually it's going to prove to be a huge sore point within Iraq itself. I think it actually may be a bigger problem in the region. many Iraqi politicians at this point are, first of all, angry with companies that dealt closely with Saddam Hussein and have no great interest in honoring contracts signed by him. And secondly, realize their only major international partner at this point is the United States. And so they certainly understand that we Americans haven't done a lot of things right. But nonetheless, they see us as their main viable partner.
So what are these contracts going to cover?
They're going to cover a certain limited amount of oil exploration and development. We're not looking at contracts of indefinite duration. That's not to say this is a good idea to publicize this the way it's been done in the last few days. This is a big public image problem. And I frankly wish that even if it had not been appropriate, that there had been some effort to bring in one or two foreign companies, because frankly, the perceptual benefit would have outweighed the economic loss to the United States of having to share a little bit of this fairly modestly sized contract.
They're just going to be repairing the oil fields, doing infrastructure work. Is that the case?
That's my understanding as well. So again, it's a limited contract. It doesn't cover the majority by any means of Iraq's future oil wealth or development. But these are nonetheless big contracts in raw dollar value terms, and they are big in the public eye because they are the main ones happening this summer.
Do they hope to get something more out of this in the long term?
I think clearly any company that's investing in Iraq today is doing so in the hope of doing better in the future than they would in the short term, because in the short term, Iraq is a very difficult place to operate. So I don't mean in any way to impugn the motives of the companies doing this. I think that they are accepting some risk, financially and otherwise, which is probably, in the scheme of things, in many ways admirable. Unfortunately, the perception is inevitably going to be of America taking the oil that many people thought we went to Iraq for in the first place. That's not accurate, but it's going to happen.
How big of a job is it going to be getting the Iraqi oil fields into shape? What's the state of the fields right now?
By all accounts from professionals, the state of the fields is quite poor. I haven't heard anyone challenge the basic contention that Saddam misused these fields for 30 years. I'm not even sure they were in great shape before that. So I think you have to look at this as a 10 to 20 year development process. In terms of the security environment in Iraq, it's becoming conceivable to think in terms of projections based on schedules for construction and drilling, because the security environment has improved enough that sometimes those schedules more or less hold. We're finally starting to see the numbers on production creep up, and we've seen the numbers of attacks on oil infrastructure go way down. So there is at least some hope that over a period of 2 to 5 years, we'll see a substantial improvement in Iraqi oil production.
But still a very iffy proposition over there. Michael Hanlon is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Your home is your castle, to borrow a phrase. And even if we can't afford a moat, we all want a home that's safe and secure. What's that mean to you? Maybe an alarm system or an extra lock or two? Now consider the kind of special security features you'd want if you lived in Beirut, Lebanon. We're talking some armor reinforcements, special windows, emergency fuel. But just think about what that adds to the cost of even a humble home. Ben Gilbert recently found that out firsthand.
Last month, there were violent clashes in my neighborhood in Beirut. Bullets bounced off my balcony, rocket-propelled grenades exploded nearby, and I found myself crouched in the only windowless room in my apartment, waiting for the next boom. That's when I decided it was time to do as the Lebanese, and began looking to make a few important purchases. First is the door. In Beirut, most apartments are decked out with thick steel doors. I asked Bruno Girardini of the El Sir Steel Company to stop by and give me an estimate. He says most steel doors have been there for years, installed during Lebanon's 15-year civil war that ended in 1990.
Before, everybody have his steel doors because everybody was out of Lebanon. Everybody.
When Lebanese left, the steel doors protected homes against burglars and looters. With tensions increasing with Iran again, I'm worried I may have to leave my home for a bit. Bruno says I can leave the home protected with a steel door for about $1,000. Now to the windows.
Hello. How are you?
John.
This is John. He sells plastic sheets of Mylar film. They're thin and transparent and stick to windows like wallpaper. He advertises Mylar by saying it blocks UV light and, quote, prevents shattering as a result of explosions.
The explosion creates a shockwave, which makes your glass fly, and it flies like bullets, and it can kill you, it can hurt you, and it will damage all your furniture and your walls and everything. So when you put this film, the glass breaks, but it doesn't shatter.
Outside on my balcony, John takes measurements. He says Mylar protection for all my windows will cost about $400, and he gleefully highlights the dangers of my exposed ninth-floor apartment.
See here, you got this stray bullet. This is another one.
The walls are scarred with mostly old bullet holes and a few new ones from last month. John says he's seen it all in this neighborhood. Artillery barrages, car bombs, and street battles. So he stays ready.
I belong to a generation where I witnessed the whole civil war. So I got trained on all these things. So whatever I can do in anticipation of, let's say, another war, I do it.
John points to his apartment building a few blocks away. He has a solar-powered hot water heater on the roof. Years ago, he and his neighbors banded together and bought a $5,000 electricity generator that can power the whole building. It reminds me of American survivalists preparing for the coming collapse of the U.S. government. Except here, that actually did happen about a month ago. The police disappeared and the army was powerless. So John says the Lebanese prepare for calamity from block to block, building to building.
Every building is an entity, is a state, which is in the autonomous, let's say, from the government. Because you have to cater for your electricity, for your water, for your everything. So you get together and say, okay, we're going to pay $2,000, $5,000 to do this and that because we want to live.
And so do I. Now that the rival factions have come to an agreement in Lebanon, the country's mostly peaceful. But still, living here means hoping for the best and preparing for the worst. So, my total tab for a generator, window protection, and a steel door, around $2,000. In Beirut, I'm Ben Gilbert for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, guess which American advertising icon is about to get shipped overseas?
Hey! Sorry, Charlie.
That's right, Charlie the Tuna. Del Monte Foods, which bought the Starkist label back in 2002, has agreed to sell the tuna brand to South Korea's Dongwon Group. The firm already operates the world's biggest tuna fishing company. Executives hope with this hook into the American market, they can create the world's biggest canned tuna business. Starkist is the top-selling canned tuna brand in the U.S., but Del Monte says the growing scarcity of tuna is increasing production costs. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 3 points, closing virtually flat. The Nasdaq fell 22 points, nearly 1%. And the S&P 500 added 1 point, about 0.1%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, a weak dollar slows summer travel in Europe.
One tour operator put it to me, it's as though the American market has just fallen off a cliff, which is exactly what the Europeans are terrified of.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.